Nutter had some choice words talking recently about a senseless murder, calling the shooter a dog, an idiot, and something I can't say on the radio. The Emmy-winning Modern Family caused quite a stir when the toddler in the sitcom dropped the F-bomb several times during one episode. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a case this month about whether and how the government should police the broadcast airwaves for profanity and nudity in the age of cable. Today in Radio Times, profanity and what to do about it. We have two guests who have joined us. Timothy Jay is a professor of psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's served as a consultant to a number of school systems. He's also been an expert witness in legal cases pertaining to obscenity and censorship, author of several books, including Cursing in America and Why We Curse. And Timothy Jay, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, I'm darn glad to be here.
Good for you. Also with us is John McWhorter. He's a professor of linguistics at Columbia University, a contributing editor at the New Republic, author of several books, including The Power of Babel, The Word on the Street, and Doing Our Own Thing. And John McWhorter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Timothy Jay, let me begin with you. And I said at the very top of the show today that it just sounds like there's more cursing. I don't know how you do research on that or not. But do we live in a world filled with more profanities?
I think that's a common perception. Certainly we're exposed to more profanity than ever before because we consume more media than ever before, and we're out in public more now than ever before. So I think that's why people carry that perception. But it's really difficult scientifically to plot these, kind of day-to-day, person-to-person changes in swearing. Our frequency counts look pretty much in 2011 look pretty much like they did 30 years ago. But what seems to be shifting is more women swearing in public than before, and certainly I'm hearing more from school teachers that younger kids are using this language more frequently at school than they have in the recent past.
And I do want to pick up on that. From your perspective, John McWhorter, what's wrong with cursing?
Well, it depends on what you call cursing, and I don't mean that to be elusive. I mean, it's certainly the case that young people are using what we call profanity more richly and more frequently and more openly with each other and also beyond than they were 30 years ago. I'm 46, and I can say that it's certainly not nostalgia that when I was a boy, 10, 11, there was cursing, especially when adults weren't around, but not to the extent that there is now. But the problem is, I think we need to refine our definition of what profanity is, because we all know that language changes, but I think we tend to put a block on an awareness of that when it comes to profanity. And this is what's important. It's not that I'm saying that I'm in love with bad words. It's not that I'm adopting some sort of libertarian perspective. But I don't think that a certain basic collection of what we often call the four-letter words today are anything that needs to be called profanity. We're used to applying that label. We call them curses, and we're told that they are bad words. But it's getting to the point where when we listen to the way 15- and 16-year-olds talk, and then, frankly, when we listen to ourselves and we watch Modern Family and we watch what that little girl did and realize how perfectly ordinary that sort of thing would be today, we have to realize that what used to be profanity now is more just colorful language, and that we have other words that are truly profane that neither Modern Family nor even South Park would play around with.
Such as racist words or sexist words or even homophobic words?
Those words. Exactly those. Mm. Those are our profanity. And so there's no way that little Lily on Modern Family would be popping off with the N-word. You know, not only would a little girl probably not do it, but that's just something that would not be depicted in a sitcom. We would say that that just was not fit for primetime consumption. And also with the F-word as unfortunately applied to homosexuals, and certainly with sexist language, those are the words that make us cover our mouths, that we shudder to imagine our children uttering, that we have teach-ins about. Those are the words that are taboo. Today, S-H-I-T, that's not profane. That's just colorful, colloquial language that we need to use with a certain caution. I think that calling that cursing today is more a matter of tradition than a real truth about how we use language in American English today.
Well, let me go back to you, Timothy Jane. We actually got a phone call to the show this morning, a mother who was complaining, and she said she likes to take her child to the local playground and watch teenagers play basketball. And she can't do that because there is so much cursing going on. And I don't know how young her child is, but this is a child. And she would love to have her child watch them, but she doesn't want to have her child hear them.
Well, you're not going to get any better user of swearing in America than an American teenager, mm-hmm. especially in an unsupervised place like a playground. Mm-hmm. I think it's incumbent on parents to teach their children about language values and what I would call media literacy, like how to consume television, cable, internet, and you're not going to inoculate your kid from this kind of language without really talking about it. And I don't think you can raise a kid without hearing this kind of language. All parents should expect that, but it's parents' responsibility to talk about mm-hmm. language values and you know what is the use of this and the misuse of this kind of language. But all American speakers of English know how to swear. You just whether you do it or not is a different question. Mm-hmm. The kids are gonna learn this anyway. Certainly, by the time they're seven, they know everything that teenagers are saying.
Go ahead, John.
You know what, Marty? To tell you the truth, I'm going to lay this out here, and I'm going to listen to it in some years and see if I can put my money where my mouth is.
Okay, we're all listening.
I'm a father for just 3 weeks now, first time.
Oh, congratulations.
So I have a lovely little girl. And I can tell you, and I mean this honestly, I would gladly take her when she is 4 or 5 years old to watch a bunch of boys playing basketball. And she can listen to all those words being dropped for 2 hours, and that is fine with me, because as far as I'm concerned, those words are no longer profanity, and she's not going to escape them. They're going to pop out of the TV. Once she gets into modern pop music, she's going to hear it. Let's think about CeeLo's song, You Can't Escape It. And, yeah, we're going to be talking about it, and I'm going to explain to her that there are words that have a certain place. You're not supposed to run around saying them. You heard them doing it. And, you know, I think that as a basically intelligent person, she's going to get it. Now, I haven't raised kids, and so I'm well aware that I may be missing something.
Yeah, be careful what you say, John. Just picking up what you just said. I mean, so you're a new father, and again, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But if your 4 or 5-year-old daughter mm-hmm. were using these words, like mm-hmm. Lily on Modern Family, mm-hmm. Would that be okay with you?
No, it would not, and I'd tell her, don't do that. And the TV show was cute because Lily couldn't quite understand. Mm. And she popped off with it at a wedding, and everybody laughed, which is exactly what would happen in real life. But I think, and that's why I say honestly, it may turn out that I am overestimating the plasticity of children
right.
on this sort of thing. I will tell my child, this is something that you shouldn't do. You are not all people. People do different things for different reasons. But you did hear that. Those are words, just like the thousands of other words that you're going to hear as you grow up. And I would like to see whether it's really such a minefield, as I've always been told, to tell children these are words that are part of the language, but you only use them at certain times or you don't use them at all. That's what I was told, and I imagine that that will work for modern kids too.
Well, let me go back to you, Timothy J., because one of your books is called Why We Curse, and, you know, true confessions here, I have used profane words, not on the radio, but there is, under certain circumstances, a kind of satisfying feeling. I don't think it's conscious in many ways. These words just are oftentimes a reaction to something that has happened. Help us understand what is driving, I guess, this desire, this need to use a profanity.
Well, the primary value of using profanity is because it's very explicit and concise about emotional feelings. You express those when you say F you. There's really no other way to say that with the level of contempt. It gets your feelings out and it conveys those effectively, efficiently to other people. And you really can't say that in other words. You know, we've evolved to use this kind of language strategically. There's no other animal that can do this. And it really picks up on our deepest emotions. And using substitute words is just not as satisfying. Either Tourette patients tell me that, And there's also, I think, although not recognized sufficiently in the literature, I think this kind of language is cathartic. We have plenty of people telling us they feel better after they do, after they get this out, and that's what we mean by venting. So in that way, you look at swearing as a strategic behavior. You do it for a reason, and it has certain social and personal effects, which make it valuable. And that's why it's been around for thousands of years.
Well, let me ask you, though, Timothy J., that if it becomes used more often and in a sense loses the taboo nature of it, does it lose its power, its ability to have that kind of satisfaction that you just described?
Well, that the desensitization of assumption, I think, is a bit of a myth. Because this language is all contextualized, and where I might feel free to use this kind of language in the locker room when I play hockey or at a bar when I'm having a beer with my buddies, I'm not going to use this language in the classroom. I'm not going to use this language in the church. And so you can become desensitized in certain contexts, but there's still sufficient forces, I'll call them institutions of power, which maintain standards and are not going to tolerate this kind of language in some context.
Going back to you, though, John McWhorter, picking up on things both you and Timothy J. have said, which is, and I think, you know, since we live in this cell phone world, there is this, it's hard sometimes to know where to draw the line between public and private conversation. And I wonder with expletives, you know, I hear people talking on their cell phones and they don't realize that, you know, the whole train is listening to them talk to their friend. I think it's hard to navigate between this public and private world that we live in, and then you throw in profanity on top of that, and people get offended sometimes.
Oh, yeah, and I think in terms of public and private, Marty, I would disagree very lightly with you in terms of the cell phone person. They know very well that we hear them. It's just that they don't care.
Oh.
And the reason they don't care is because we're a more informal society than we were 30 and certainly 40 and 50 years ago. And so I honestly think that a person like that doesn't consider themselves to be uttering an oath in the way that they would if they used certain other words very casually. For example, nobody would use the N-word as a slur. Now, I don't mean the way that many black men call each other dear and buddy by using it. But nobody on a cell phone would be using that word in a train, referring in the mean way. That would be considered profane. But using some other words, it's just considered colorful language. I think also we're distorted by the fact that there's a difference between the past as we see it depicted in pop culture, which is all we've got, and then our pop culture now. So it's easy to think that because you watched The Honeymooners or you watched an old movie even about seedy people and they didn't curse, we think, okay, people didn't curse as much back then, whereas today you watch Modern Family and even a little girl is dropping the F-bomb. But of course, we have to think about what did people sound like when they were actually real people not being recorded in 1950. And I think they cursed less, but I think they cursed a whole lot more than we often think about. But we can't hear people having conversations in 1950 because nobody had a tape recorder.
Well, hold on to that thought. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation talking about profanity and what to do about it. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo, wishing you a happy and healthy new year. We're celebrating in all my restaurants, 4710 and 2012, the Year of the Dragon with a special Year of the Dragon menu. Margaret Kuo's restaurants support WHYY.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
If you tune to WHYY more than 4 hours a week, then you're a loyal listener.
And since you are, you might be interested in our YStream service.
YStream is a thank you gift that gives you online access to programs without pledge breaks.
Make your donation to WHYY before Monday, and you can listen pledge-free on your iPad, iPhone, PC, or Mac.
Visit whyy.org/YStream for details.
Although the butt of jokes, Brussels sprouts are highly nutritious members of the cabbage family. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the special tricks it takes to produce sprouts with a surprisingly sweet taste, plus answers to an especially large selection of your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Penn State Law and universities from around the world premiere World on Trial, an international human rights courtroom television drama, Tuesday night at 6 and 9 p.m. on the Y Info Channel. Details at worldontrial.psu.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the words you can't say on the radio. On the radio, we are talking about cursing and what, if anything, to do about it. Let me formally reintroduce our guest. John McWhorter is a professor of linguistics at Columbia University, contributing editor at The New Republic, author of several books about language. Timothy J., professor of psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of several books on cursing. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Timothy, let me pick up on something John was saying right before the break about in the 1950s, we didn't have tape recorders, so we didn't know how much and how often people cursed. And I know that Deadwood was a fictional show about the West and about the development of the West, and it had more expletives in that show than I think I've ever heard anywhere. And the author of that, the writer of the screenplay, David Milch, said, based on his research, this was how people talked back in the West. And I'd just be curious about, again, maybe where we even started our conversation, whether we are or not cursing more now.
Well, the times shift and values shift. We have recently laws against discrimination, gender discrimination, sexual harassment. So there's still, why we think, a lot of contexts are freer than they were. I think the workplace, certainly with more women in it now, is different. But I think we have plenty of reason to believe that soldiers have always talked dirty, and other communities, prostitutes. You can think of how would the bar room of the past be any different than it is now when you've got a lot of drunk men in there? And certainly, this language has been documented since Chaucer wrote about different kinds of people. And I think if you look at the accounts of war, war has always had a great effect on swearing, especially the recent wars where we have. Like the Vietnam War, where you have a lot of soldiers coming together from different parts of America and learning each other's swear words and insults. So I have no reason to believe that that life in a barroom brothel in 100 years ago was any different than it is now.
So sailors have cursed like sailors, you're saying.
Yes.
John, go ahead. You want to add something?
People in the past refer to cursing, especially among men and especially in grimier circumstances, all the time, even if they don't enumerate it. Or just think about this. Think about Looney Tunes. Think about especially Yosemite Sam. Rocker, fracker, 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 and he always does that. Well, what was that supposed to symbolize? Audiences back then knew what he was saying. And when he does the rocker, fracker, rocker, fracker, it even sounds like a very specific curse, one of the longer ones that begins with M, which shows that that was something that people were very clearly aware of. And I have a source. I was researching an article on Louis Armstrong back a few years ago, and there are tapes that he would make of just him and people he knew in his house just sort of chewing the fat. And they're not especially profane, but they sound exactly the way people like that would sound now, including liberal use of the SHIT word, including his wife Lucille in certain very articulate circumstances. These were people just talking. It's rare to have a recording of people just sitting around chewing the fat before rather recently. Mm. But when you do, they sound pretty much like us. So things are not as different now as we often think.
Timothy J., let me pick up on something that you said earlier, then we'll get to our callers. And you said that it looks like more women are cursing more. Is there a reason for that?
Well, there are more women in public. There are more women in positions of power, more women under stress now than there have ever been. Swearing is, in a way, it's all about power. You either have very little power, so you got nothing to lose, and why not use the language, or you've got enough power that you can use it, without retribution. So I think as women enter positions like courtroom lawyers or work in manual labor jobs, you're going to find more of this. So where we had about two-thirds, when we went out in public and recorded people swearing, two-thirds of the data were from men. Now it's more like 55% of the data are men, and And so that's what we see it kind of evening out there a little more.
Does that surprise you, John?
That change in relatively little time is certainly interesting. It feels intuitive, but I didn't know that there were numbers that precise. That is interesting.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. It looks like we have Francis from Temple joining us on Radio Times. Francis, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I agree with Jonathan earlier that you know, really there is some offensive language out there, be it gender-based, be it racially based. That is truly offensive material. But I think that really our attitudes about swearing in this country, generally speaking, very, very poor and messed up. We honestly have real issues, or maybe not everyone, but a lot of people are much more offended by, you know, let's say the F word or the S word, which describes just natural actions, than they are by things like, you know, inequality, than things like poverty, ecological disaster. People are less offended by these kind of words than they are about, you know, a lot of violence in our society. And I think it's rather stupid. I mean, the rest of the world, maybe not the rest of the world, but at least, Western Europe, they don't care. I mean, if you go to France, every other word is putain, which is, you know, their equivalent of the F word. So,
Well, Francis, let me take your point, and your phone line is not the greatest, and I don't want to lose you, but let me give John McWhorter a chance to weigh in, saying that people are offended by cursing, but they're not offended as much by poverty or income inequality. Does he have a point there?
Oh, yeah, Francis is quite right. When I think about my own child, the way I see it is we're a more advanced society if what we're going to put a taboo on is expressions having to do with oppression and inequality and dismissing other groups. I hope my child is smart, and if she is, if she asks me, why can't I say the F word, the one with only four letters in it? And I say, well, you can't talk about that because it implies that people have sex and reproduce and perhaps enjoy it. And then she says, well, why can't I say the N word, if that's what she chooses? And I say, well, you can't say that because it harkens to the oppression of black people over 400 years. And if she doesn't understand that one of those is more important than the other, if she asks why we have to be so concerned about the F1 as opposed to the N1, as far as I'm concerned, we shouldn't be. I think that it's a little primitive of us to still be telling kids not to say that sucks because of what it implies, when these are natural things that have always gone on that they're going to go on and do, as opposed to things about homosexuality and women and people of other races. That's advanced thought. The rest of it is the sort of thing you would expect of some tribe somewhere, and I think that we're more developed than that.
Are we more developed than that, Timothy J? Because some of your research is that we seem to be hardwired for this cursing.
I think if you look back into other more highly evolved primates, you'll see they have this kind of a signal alarm system, and whether that's the rudiments of cursing is, I guess, up for speculation. But it's interesting to watch how children express anger and frustration early on, where they do it very physically. They do screaming. They do biting. If you send your kid to a daycare, I guarantee they'll come home with scratches or bites on him. But when they start to learn how to use offensive language, those kind of primitive, aggressive aspects of emotional expression seem to disappear. And I think from that point, it's an evolutionary advantage to be able to do express emotions symbolically and not have to do it physically. But I wanted to speak about one other thing about language values and just like kind of how this fits in world problems. I think last week when we focused so much attention on language on a television show, like Francis said, we're really avoiding bigger real world problems. I mean, for the media to just kind of like focus on themselves. Children don't learn how to swear from television. It's not that big of a deal, and I think it's just a way to draw attention and make money and sell advertisements for those kind of shows at the expense of really getting a deeper a sense or reaction to things like a real world bullying at school and discrimination and other forms of, poverty. And I think it's just it's almost a scapegoat for, it's so easy to pick on television. It just, and television language, I think it's kind of a useless exercise. size anymore.
Francis, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're talking about profanity, what it means, and what, if anything, to do about it. Timothy Jay, psychology professor at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, and he's the author of a couple of books called Cursing in America and Why We Curse. Also with us is John McWhorter. He's a professor of linguistics at Columbia University, a contributing editor at The New Republic, author of several books as well, The Power of Babel, The Word on the Street, and then Doing Our Own Thing. I just got to read the subtitle of that book, The Degradation of Language and Music in America and Why We Should, Like, Care. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's see what Marianne from Cape May has to say. Marianne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and kind of echo what one of your guests said. I'm a mother and I have four kids, and I've been trying to raise them, acknowledging the fact that there is this kind of language out there. And what I've chosen to do is we don't call them bad words. We call them grown-up words. And that is for the main words that we've said are maybe not considered that profane anymore. I also agree with your guest in that there are still words that are absolutely forbidden and are what I consider profane, but they're not your run-of-the-mill curse words. Those words, because I have said them, used them, I try not to in front of my children, but I don't call them bad words. I say they're just words. They have more emphasis. We talk about how you might be perceived if you use them and that some people view it as more coarse, and so that might be a reason why you might choose not to use them. But in terms of rules in our household, we say they're grown-up words, and just like some things like driving or drinking, you wait in your life. You wait to use these words because I do think kids are not as good, and of course not all grown-ups are great at it either, at using that filter of understanding what environment are you in, you know, how should I be speaking in this place. Kids will slip up more. So if they aren't as practiced at using them, if there are some rules about it, perhaps that means you won't have them slipping up at a wedding and blurting out a word they're not supposed to.
Fair enough.
That's just the way we've kind of addressed it in our house.
Well, I appreciate the call, Marianne, to Radio Times. And John McWhorter, as a new parent, I'd be curious about your response. Grown-up words.
That sounds perfectly normal, and I grew up in Philadelphia, so I imagine it happening right in that city. Grown-up is a good way of putting it. I remember hearing the sort of standard curse words. My parents, middle-class upbringing I had in Mount Airy, they were using those words now and then, and I would ask about them. I remember asking about D-A-M-N and coming away thinking that D-A-M-N and D-A-M were different words somehow because of the way my father described it. Mm-hmm. And the idea was just that you don't do that till you're grown, and that made sense to me in exactly the same way as the alcohol. You know, it smelled kind of good, but the idea was, no, you can't have it, and I didn't need a philosophical discussion as to exactly why. And that was that. Now, of course, in, say, 1972, I wasn't hearing as much of that sort of thing coming from TV, coming from movies, and out in the driveway. Not from TV at all, and out in the driveway and at school some, but not to such an extent. But I'm not sure the difference is as profound as some people think. If you've got any kind of control over your kids, then you just say, this will happen later. And as we all know, later comes very, very soon.
Fair enough. Timothy Jay, anything you want to add to that?
Oh, we've surveyed hundreds of people about rules in the house, and most parents do have rules. Two-thirds of parents do have rules forbidding swearing and sometimes around certain people, and they have restrictions on what they can listen to and what they can watch. But it's also interesting that two-thirds of those parents also break those rules. So I think that's the other thing you have to be careful with. You always have to have room in there for slip-ups, both parents and the kids. But it seems to be pretty clear that parents restrict this kind of language. We've also looked at the way parents punish their kids when they swear, and most parents use verbal reprimands. But we were the first group, first lab to show the extensiveness of soap in the mouth, which is also an interesting American cultural phenomenon as a punishment for using, I guess, metaphorically dirty language. You get soap in the mouth, and
I got that. Yeah,
yeah,
you got
that.
Well, that just
I remember getting that once. Yeah.
And did that put a stop to your potty mouth, John McWhorter?
Never said H-E-L-L again until I was about 17.
That's what our data show. Regardless of how parents punish their children and restrict them, 95% of them go on to use some or a lot of swear words as adults.
Let me see what looks like Dorsey from Newcastle has to say. And Dorsey, go ahead. You're on Radio
yes,
Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
A number of times that your guests have referred to this as colorful language, and it's not. It just bespeaks a paucity of vocabulary, in my opinion. All you have to do is look at some of Shakespeare's swearing, which is marvelous and very, very different, you know, very various. And I do think that these words lose their power, especially the obscenities, because you're not really differentiating between a profanity and obscenity. And I think the word, for instance, that begins with F can be very strong, especially if you're using it in writing, and I'm a writer. But if you hear it every whip stitch, it just means nothing.
Well, Dorsey, let me give First Timothy J a chance to weigh in on that. And she's talking about, in a sense, a kind of poverty of language. What do you think?
That's a myth. People don't use swear words because they can't think of other words. In fact, we're just finishing some studies here in our lab where we look at how people are fluent with language. And people that are fluent with language are also fluent with swearing. So it's not the people at the low end of the spectrum, the undereducated use this kind of language. It pervades all levels and college students with great vocabularies, 40, 50,000, 100,000 word vocabularies, they are still good at swearing. So I think it also to say that it's a poverty of language, I think also ignores the strategic uses of it, the value of it. And a lot of times these are very important reasons why people use a particular word. But other times it's what I would just call a conversation. And it really has little meaning in a lot of contexts.
John, you want to add to that?
Well, I can quickly say that I know what the caller means, but in fact, cursing can be quite beautiful if you can put a certain filter in your head as to what you think of as appropriate. The word ASS, and I have a discussion of this, so to speak, in my latest book, what language is, what language isn't, and what it could be. The word ASS is used in a way that challenges grammarians to figure out exactly scientifically how it's being used as a part of speech, etc. And I can't use the sentences on the air, but a lot of the way ASS is used is quite articulate in ways that you could do a whole book on the fate of the word ASS in the English language from year one until now. In one sentence, it was actually uttered by somebody, was, and I'll just go instead of saying ASS. This is somebody who was in the Iraq War who said, I don't want that person with her English speaking to dispatch me tomorrow. Now imagine somebody saying that, and it means all sorts of things. It's a very precise way of expression. And so I don't know if it's always that somebody doesn't have another word to use. It's that those words, because of their color, so to speak, are part of expressing the full range of what it is to be human and have feelings.
And we have to say goodbye to you, John, but it sounds like you're also talking about context, which is, I mean, they're standalone words, and then there's, of course, context, which is where,
exactly,
many ways, where the meaning is.
Exactly. Emotion, attitude, all of that is part of language as well.
Well, on that note, John McWhorter, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. Once again, congratulations on your new baby.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's a professor of linguistics at Columbia University, a contributing editor at The New Republic. Timothy J. staying with us for the rest of the hour, psychology professor at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of several books on cursing, and that's what we're talking about today in Radio Times. Then after this short break, we'll be joined by Katie Davis from Harvard Project Zero. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital joins you in supporting WHYY. Jefferson Hospital for Neuroscience is dedicated to the care and treatment of patients with aneurysms, acute strokes, AVMs, and brain tumors. Employing the latest in non-invasive technologies, including endovascular coiling, interventional stroke therapies, gamma knife, and shaped beam surgery. To schedule an appointment or for information, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
Did you say I've got a lot to learn?
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Etta James. She died last week at the age of 73. And we'll listen to our 2009 interview with Woody Allen. His film Midnight in Paris has been nominated for a Best Picture Oscar. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What's going on in Libya? Reports of pro-Gaddafi loyalists taking back towns. We'll get a report from Tripoli. Also, the Facebook timeline, kind of a file cabinet for everything you've ever put on Facebook, whether you like it or not. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking, yes, indeed we are, about cursing today on the radio. Timothy J. has been our guest for the full hour, psychology professor at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Before we get Katie Davis in on the conversation, Timothy J., I just want to ask you a question, something that I ran across reading some of your research. Is it extroverts are more likely to curse than, what, introverts?
Yeah, that makes sense. We're just starting to unearth some of those personality variables in recent research, but that's one. We also type A personalities that are hostile, use a lot of this language. People who don't use this kind of language usually rank high in religiosity, mm-hmm. or they have sex anxiety, so they don't like to use sexual terms. And people who rank high in agreeableness and conscientiousness also are less likely to use this language. But, yep, the extroverts, relative to introverts, are swearers.
And do you see this language as sort of aggressive? Is it aggressive language? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I think these words are like tools that can be used for a lot of different things. So the word is really, its meaning is really contextualized. So words can be used in a sexual way. They can be aggressive, hostile, but they can also be enticing. They can be, weird as it sounds, they can be in terms, used as terms of endearment. So it really depends on the relationship between two people. But certainly most of what we record looks like frustration or some type of verbal aggression. But I got to say, we've recorded over 10,000 people swearing in public, mm-hmm. and we've never seen it turn to anything hostile or anything that I would say is bad. And so most of these, the overwhelming majority of this is what I would say conversational, and it's not, you know, it's not any sign of some type of deviance, and it's not any sign of, you know, like a gateway into physical aggression.
Well, let me get Katie Davis in on the conversation. She's a project manager at Harvard Project Zero, investigating the role of digital media technologies in adolescents' academic, social, and moral lives. Also serves as an advisory board member for MTV's digital abuse campaign, A Thin Line. And Katie Davis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we're happy to have you with us. And Timothy J. had said earlier that, not surprisingly, adolescents curse. Does that surprise you as someone who works with adolescents?
No, not at all. As someone who works with them, and also I have two teenage sisters, and I can avow that, indeed, they do like to curse.
And looking at, we've been talking largely about the analog world, you know, how people operate in public. I do want to talk with you a bit about the digital world. How do you see profanity being used online?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I serve on the advisory board for MTV's digital abuse campaign, and MTV recently came out with a poll that looked at, they polled kids ages 14 to 24, and they found that 71%, so almost three-quarters of teens, say that people their age are more likely to use slurs, and these are the types that John was talking about earlier, not the swearing, but more of the racist and sexist language. So kids think that people are more likely to use that type of language online than they are to use it offline.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think the answer might be in another one of their questions, which was they asked, you know, how seriously do you take this? And most kids, and this is reflected in the work that we do at Harvard Project Zero, most kids feel that this type of language, when it's used online, doesn't really count. It's not really serious, and they sort of discount what they say online as just a joke, and their friends will know that they're just joking and they're not being serious. But of course, when it's online, it's often not just reaching their friends, but it could also, what they say, can reach a much broader audience.
And is part of that just that, not, I mean, the anonymity of the internet, for instance, but also, I mean, we're talking about social networks here. So in many ways, these are people that know each other, that are talking to each other, but somehow they feel as if what they can say online, they can't say in public.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. They feel that for some reason, it's whether or not it's because they feel a sort of sense of security that they're typing something in and it's only in front of a computer screen. They can't see the person's reaction on the other side. And there's this sort of sense that it doesn't really count. It's not the same. And in my own research, talking with adolescents, when I ask them to compare how they talk to their friends offline versus online, a lot of them, especially the girls, say it's much easier to be mean online because you don't have to face someone's reaction. You don't have to see whether or not what you've said actually hurts them, or if they do express hurt, it's often delayed because they have to type it in and press send. And so I think that it's that sort of difference between the online and the offline world that makes quite a big difference.
Well, Timothy J., let me give you a chance to respond to that, then I do want to get back to our callers. Does that surprise you at all?
No, I think if you think about the context of the Internet, you can see some interesting variables there that also affect real-world swearing. One is anonymity, that a lot of times you don't know who is out there writing. And the other is there's no authority to punish you, reprimand you. And so that, I think you get more freedom to be mean or profane on the Internet because it's not policed. And I think that's part of when we saw people reacting against PIPA and SOPA this week. I think part of that is a sense that there would be some infringement on free speech on the Internet, but for, I guess, for good reasons and also bad reasons, but certainly I think anonymity and the lack of repercussions on the Internet breeds free speech.
Well, let me just pick up on something that Katie Davis said, and also picking up on what something that you and John McWhorter were talking about, which is that while people might feel free to curse in public, chances are they wouldn't use racist or sexist or homophobic language, and yet it seems online people feel more comfortable using that kind of language. Does that make sense to you, Timothy?
Yeah, again, I think it's that lack of repercussion, too, in a sense of maybe you're using a pseudonym to do your talking. And I think we found little racist and sexist language in our recent children's sample, but also kind of an insensitivity about it with, for example, young boys use a 5-, 6-, 7-year-old boys use a word like fag. Not really knowing what it means, and certainly see that word used a lot online in websites like Reddit.
Yeah.
So certainly is a lot out there, but it takes a while in the culture to figure out the nuances of all these words, and you have a different sensitivity about the use of that word amongst teenagers. So I think what we see kids talking in the real world, that translates into what they're doing online.
And Katie Davidson, we'll get back to our callers. Does this mean there should be some kind of, language police force online, or can young people self-police?
Well, actually, I think it's really interesting. In another recent survey conducted by the Pew Internet and American Life Project, they asked kids, who has the biggest influence on you in terms of how you think about what's appropriate and not appropriate to do and say online? And by far, the majority of kids said that their parents have the biggest influence on them. So 58% of them said their parents, followed by 18% said their friends. And I think that is really promising, because I think parents sometimes feel that, I can't see what my kids are doing online, therefore I don't really have much control over what they do and I don't have much influence. But they parents actually do have a lot lot to say, and it's important that they model positive behavior online.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Mara from Lehigh Valley. Mara, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I think it's a good point to make that when you get into the high school age, when a lot of kids begin cursing on their own, it's not so much for the effect or the definition of the word. I believe it's more or less the shock value that they get from saying that. You know, they've heard these words on TV from their parents or whatever. They know that they're not supposed to use it, but they get into that rebellion phase to where saying these words, they say the look on their friends' faces, the look on their teachers' faces, they get the giggles, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. I think a big part of what starts these kids cursing is just the reaction that they get from their friends.
Mara, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kitty Davis, do you agree? Shock value?
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, it's all a part, I think, of creating peer norms. And in adolescence, that becomes a time when you're distancing yourself from your family and your parents in terms of how you identify, and you're identifying more with your peers. And, you know, that's when they come up with norms in terms of their language use and what they wear and how they act. And it's sort of a way to define yourself with respect to the peer group and not and in opposition to adult culture in some ways.
Rebellious words, Timothy J.
Well, it's part of being an adolescent, testing the boundaries of things, trying to fit in. Everything we've studied here shows that swearing is normal. You would be the oddball if you didn't swear in high school. You know, I think you can just walk down the hall and make those kind of judgments about your peers. You know, most of them are, you know, that's kind of the freest time they're going to be in their life. But I'm also happy, you know, Katie reported the results of that Pew study, because it reinforces what we know, certainly about swearing, about language values come from parents, siblings, from the backyard. They don't come from television. You know, people don't learn how to swear from television. And I think there's much too big of a deal made about this for those conservative media watchdogs that complain about this all the time. Kids learn this at home, at school. That's where the language values come from, not from television.
And just to underscore what you said there, Timothy J., I mean, a lot of parents curse in front of their kids, curse at their children. I mean, use this language all the time.
Yeah, again, it's normal, especially with parents that have trouble with coping skills or have trouble with anger management. And I think parents would be better off, you know, rather than worrying about a word that was said, focus more on the emotions that your kids have. Why are they using this kind of language? Do they want your attention? Are they really angry? Do they have trouble with anger management? Do they have bad coping skills? Those things are better life skills than just telling someone not to say a word without really helping them understand, you know, why they're using this language.
Let me get Jason from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. Jason, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead. All right. We seem to be having some trouble with line one today. Kitty Davis, just looking at the computer screen here, Jason is wanted to make a comment about being, you know, immersed in more media. And I mean, I think that can be probably a truism about all of us, which is that we just live in a, you know, whether we're online all day long or at work or at home, we live in a very media saturated world.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that today's social media really changes many dynamics of interpersonal communication. So I think that's why you're finding that kids experience different sorts of language norms online versus offline. But I think it's important, just going back to the adult piece and parents' role, it's important for us to make kids aware of the broader consequences of some of their language online, because if they just feel that they're just joking around online and their friends know it, and they're not aware of the broader consequences to audiences that they don't really understand are listening or reading what they're saying, you know, I think that it's important for educators and parents to really pay attention to that and help them, engage them in discussion so that they can begin to think about those broader consequences.
Timothy J., let me just end with a question to you about the Supreme Court. They heard arguments in a case about whether, how the government should police broadcast airwaves for things like profanity and nudity, and just adding to the complexity in this age of cable. How significant do you think this decision will be?
Well, it has the potential to reverse that questionable Pacifica standard from the George Carlin. Where we came up with the indecency standard, which has pretty much been unpoliceable, and it's really, I think it really harkens to that vague and overbroad terminology that lawyers use, that it's, and broadcasters really can't figure out what they can say and what they can't, and why is the language in Saving Private Ryan acceptable, but Scorsese's documentary on the blues isn't. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense. And certainly, I think it's the premise of protecting children from this kind of language.
Right.
I mean, John Douglas, the guy who complained about this, had a 15-year-old kid. Well, all 15-year-olds, you know, they know all adults swearing, and in a way, it's kind of false in that you're protecting what 7-8-year-olds from words they already know. There's better things to be done, but it could redress that the problems with that 78 decision. But I think underlying this is really the politics of the FCC and how all the trouble comes about, or the recent trouble comes about with the standard by the conservatives that Bush put on the FCC. And you don't notice, you're not seeing this kind of trouble with the FCC under the Obama administration.
Well, very interesting, and a case to be watched. Timothy J., thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Hey, again, I'm darn glad to be here. I was in good company today, too.
Yeah, you were in good company. And he's a psychology professor at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of Cursing in America and Why We Curse. Katie Davis, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
You're
my
welcome.
Pleasure.
Pleasure to have you with us. Project manager at Harvard Project Zero. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can go there to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Emily Bryant is our intern. Our fill-in producer, Jonathan Best, produced this particular hour of Radio Times. And the producers of Radio Times are Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us.